Blog Talk Radio.
Without the light, or the darkness comes. Hold through the night, the shadows will run. Fend off the enemy. The jubilee with all the fire we can breathe. We're singing all day and you can't tame it. High tide, low tide, you know. Night time, morning time, yeah. We're going strong, heading up, down the river. Oh Lord, I feel the reveling. I feel a change on the rise. Man who's lost his soul can't take a stand when his flame's gone cold. Fend off the enemy, sing out the fire we can breathe. We're singing all day and you can't tame it. High tide, low tide, you know. Night time, morning time, yeah. We're going strong, heading up, down the river. Oh Lord, I feel the reveling. I feel a change on the rise.
All right. This is Trusty Training. I'm giving everybody a chance to definitely get in where they fit in. Hopefully I'm coming in loud and clear. Hopefully everybody can hear me. Call-in number where you can actually call in to get your questions answered is going to be 319-527-6090. Again, the number where you can call in to get your questions answered in this Trusty Training is going to be 319-527-6090. Today's topic is no more misunderstanding. And I'm going to make this a kind of a, like a, I'm going to talk about civics and I'm going to talk about accounting all in the same breath. No more misunderstanding is, there's a lot of ways to look at how one would utilize the present economic system. For example, a lot of private institutions or corporations are literally using scenarios such as their position under the Hague Convention. Some countries and commerce are actually protected or are governed under the Hague Convention. And if you don't know whether or not that's applicable to your situation, I suggest you do some research. So again, we're going to give you the do's and the don'ts. Those of you that are fairly new to the Law of Nations curriculum, you got to teach this, you know, a while back, so this is going to be pretty much a refresher for you guys. For those who've never heard, you know, anything from that perspective, you know, take notes because it's probably going to be some stuff you probably never heard before. For those of you that are kind of in an accounting space that's trying to look for which way to go, I suggest that you just take some inventory because I'm going to cover all of the above and then some. And preferably, in order for you to know where you're going, you got to know where you came from. So let's talk about no more misunderstanding. And I emphasize the word more, not M-O-R-E, but M-O-O-R. Kind of let me explain this. Matter of fact, I'm going to let the teachers teach. I'm going to give you a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and we're going to meet in the middle. So keep listening, because if you listen long enough, you'll learn something. Pay attention. This one. Yeah, here we go. Right here.
Alright, so we're going to begin this video with a reference here from the Sundervan Pictorial Bible Dictionary. I've actually found an original version of this in the archive.org website. Alright, again, the Sundervan Pictorial Bible Dictionary. General Editor is Merrill C. Tini, Dean of the Graduate School of Theology, Wheaton College, Wheaton, Illinois. All right, Associate Editor, Stephen Barabas, PhD, Picture and Layout Editor, Peter Deviser, with the assistance of 65 contributors, scholars, and experts in various fields. All right? So this is from 1963, 1964, and 1967 copies. All right? So these are the sources of the pictures that says here. You can see all the sources. All right? And contributors to this work, this book, this dictionary, all right? Just an example, Polly Adolf, School of Medicine, University of Pennsylvania. All right, look at this. All right, so these are all the people helping out and contributing in this book. All right, all of these are like college PhD professors and stuff. This is a very scholarly book, actually. It's not just any book. I know you've heard about it before when we were, you know, looking for certain words and stuff. All right, and we've run into this book, but this book actually has changed over the years. This book from the 1960s, very thorough, right? It's very original. It has a lot of information that was taken out or changed. The words changed as time went on. I can show you different versions of this, because I do have them, but I'd like to show you this is the original first ones, you know, printed in the 60s. All right, so these are all the contributors again. So we're in page 330. We're in the H's, right? Just wanted to start this video with this definition so you can get a feeling of what where I'm taking this, all right? So it says Ham, right? So it's the youngest son of Noah, born probably about 96 years before the flood. And one of the eight persons to live through the flood, he became the progenitor of the dark races, but not the Negroes. Again, very important, right? I know that kind of confuses a lot of people, all right? But like we've been trying to say, all skin folk ain't king folk, all right? Again, Ham, he is the progenitor of the dark races, but not the Negroes, all right? Not the Nagas, not the Negroes, not the copper color races in America, but of the Egyptians, Ethiopians, Libyans, and Canaanites. His indecency when his father lay drunken brought a curse upon Canaan. All right? I know a lot of the people fight that because they're trying to say, oh, that's just like a white man to blame the only so-called Negro, right, as the one being cursed. But again, they're telling you straight up here that Ham, he is a progenitor of dark races, but not of the Negroes, the Nagas, the Negus, the Nagas, the kings, the priest kings. He's the progenitor of the Egyptians, Ethiopians, Libyans, and Canaanites, all right? And one thing we have to know and dodge the hijack in is that we assume that Japhet was white, that Shem was, you know, white like the white Israelites, and that Ham was the only Negro, and that's totally false, totally false. So that whole, oh, they're just trying to blame the dark-skinned man and curse him, no, that's you're wrong. It has nothing to do with complexion. Has nothing to do with complexion. All right? Again, Ham is the progenitor of the dark races, but not the Negroes. Not the Negroes. Yes, dark races, but not the Negroes. Doesn't mean, this is telling you straight up, that not all dark-skinned people in the world are related or of the same, you know, nation, tribe, or whatever, you know, or ancestor. All right, so now we're in this book or article, scholarly, actually, you know, it's called Moors, Moabites, and Berbers. Are these names and people historically synonymous? Analyzing historical, biblical, and archaeological correlations by Cheek Way L of the Moorish American Research Group for the Moorish Science Society, March 23rd, 2017. This is just 2 years ago. All right, let's get up to date. All right, so who is Cheek Way L? So we're in this website, independentacademia.edu. I get a lot of very scholarly articles from this website. So we find Cheek Way L here. It says, Moorish American researcher seeking to prove the historical doctrine of Prophet Noble Druilli and other related topics. All right, we're going to get into this article right now, which I have open, and this is another one here. It's another website here, lulu.com, I guess a bookstore or whatever. So it says about Cheek Way L, and these are some of the books he's got. The Moabites. Who are the Moors? Moabites, Holy Quran of the Moorish Shrine Temple of America, Moorish Literature Compiled Articles and Lectures, Moorish American Civics and Guide, Debunking the Myth of Blackness. All right, you ain't black. Moore's been telling you for years, that's just a tag, right? Doesn't hold up in law or anything. Don't call yourself black, that don't mean nothing. The Moorish Scientist Book 1. All right, and so on. So, I mean, he's very important in this Moorish community with the teachings and the history. All right, I don't know, because I don't know Moors that read his books, but I would consider him, if I was a Moor, somebody you can trust with information, or maybe, or has a strong influence. All right, he has a lot to say. He has a lot of books published. All right, maybe some Moors may not agree, saying, oh, no, he doesn't represent all of us, but hey. What I just wanted to show is that he wrote an article, and it's very historical, all right, and that's what I want to show. So let's go back to the book. All right, so we're back in the article, and it starts, the Moorish Americans are descendants of the ancient Moabites who inhabited northwestern and southwestern shores of Africa, all right? Prophet Noble Druilli said this numerous times. What does he mean by that? What's a Moabite? You know? And what do you mean they inhabited Africa? Thought it was America. Alright, so the above quote, along with several others that will be highlighted throughout this exposition, as given by Prophet Noble Druilli, founder of the Moorish Science Movement in America, and the first Islamic organization, the first Islamic organization in the United States of America, serves as a perplexing paradox between what is perceived as biblical invention and historical reality. All right? This paper intends to show the historical records that verify the above quote said by Prophet Noble Druilli, extracted from what was at first thought to be a strange doctrine. In fact, if you were to compare the Nation of Islam's page on Wikipedia and the Moorish Science Temple of America's page, you will notice that the doctrine of the Nation of Islam is extensively examined, while the doctrine of the Moorish Science Temple of America is hardly spoken about. When it comes to the subject of Noble Druilli, more emphasis is placed upon scholastic guesswork than anything tangible. There are so many sources that this researcher has come across that has ostensibly stigmatized the Moabite aspect of Ali's teachings, along with several other aspects of the Moorish American Muslim doctrine that he brought for practice and study. The main charge levied is that Noble Druilli essentially invented a history by approaching Moorish roots and then combining them with the biblical Moabites and Canaanites. emphasis is placed upon the word biblical. By placing Moab and Canaan in a biblical container, it anchors several psychological aspects. It creates the notion that Moab can only be found in the biblical record and has no other place outside of it. It highlights the shameful origins of Moab as a child of incest. All right? So he's kind of saying that, you know, Moab and Canaan and all these nations and tribes and people, these references, words, are not just only found in the Bible. It's what he's trying to let you know. And that it seems like in the Bible, right, he's trying to say they're making them sound bad. Especially when they're talking about Moab, right? Moab was from Lot and his daughter, right? So they're saying that Moab is a child of incest in the Bible, right? I mean, I'm sure you've read that, right? So they're kind of not liking that part, right? For those who practice European psychology, to which has been dubbed white supremacy, this literary attempt to keep the Moabites, who are from Canaan, all right? Canaan is said to represent the Negro. All right, so Canaan is said to represent the Negro. So where does that, you know, how does that relate? How is Canaan related to Negro? All right. All right, so again, we're in the Sonderbell Bible dictionary, right? And it says Canaan, Canaanites. All right, so they just told us the Canaan, Canaanites meant Negro in that article, right? It says here that Canaan was the son of Ham. In the genealogical list in Genesis 9:10, his descendants occupied Canaan and took their name from that country. It says Canaan was one of the old names for Palestine, the land of Canaanites disposed by the Israelites. So Canaanites were occupying Judea or Israel, the original promised land, or Canaan. Right? Israel's a nation, not a place, right? So this was basically taken over by the Israelites, or Joshua, when they kicked out the Canaanites, right? Canaanites, when they kicked out the Canaanites. The etymology of the name is unknown, as is also the earliest history of the name. But Egyptian inscriptions of 1800 BC use it for the coastline between Egypt and Asia Minor. In the Amarna letters of 1400 BC, the name is applied to the Phoenician coast. According to Judges 1:9-10, Canaanites dwelt throughout the land. In Genesis 12:6, 24:3, 37, Joshua 3:10, the Canaanites include the whole pre-Israelite population, even east of the Jordan. The language of Canaan, in Isaiah 19:18, refers to the group of West Semitic languages, of which Hebrew, Phoenician, Moabite were dialects. Moabite, Phoenician. The Canaanites were of Semitic stock and were part of the large migration of Semites, Phoenicians, Amorites, Canaanites, right? Who are these people? When they're talking about Semitic, from Northeast Arabia in the 3rd millennium BC, they came under Egyptian control in 1500 BC. The Israelites were never able to completely exterminate them. Many were undoubtedly absorbed by their conquerors. The continued presence rendered the religious problem of the Israelites serious and difficult. All right, so again, Ham, right? Because they just told us the Canaan meant Negro, right? In that article from Sheikh Elway, right? But it says here that Ham, right, he's the progenitor of dark races, yes, but not the Negroes. Not the Negroes. Dark races, yes. A lot of different dark races on earth, right? Dark complexion people. But they don't mean that they are part of the Negroes, or those who are being called Negroes, Negus, Nagas. If you got Negus, right, in Ethiopia, that means king, right, emperor, king. If you add a R, you got Negrus. You go to Europe and these people start translating, so it becomes Negroes eventually. You got the Nagas, Naga, Negrus, Negus. All right, again, Ham. It's a progenitor, yes, of the dark races, but not the Negroes. Not the Negroes. Not the Negroes. Now, I want to show you this. I found this like 2-3 years ago. I haven't used it that much. I've been wanting to use it a lot more with the videos. Just haven't been able to get to it. It's so much info, right? But I just want to show you. This is a chronology timeline. I call it chronology of a hijack in detail. because it's basically what they teach us, supposedly chronology, right? The way they teach us, you know, starting from all the way to Adam, right? Cain, Abel, Adam and Eve, Enoch, see their lines and everything, and it keeps going. The patriarchs, right? The original patriarchs before the flood. And then we get to Noah, right? So let me just zoom in. So this chronology, if you print it out, it's about 20 to 25 feet long. It's really big, so you can zoom in a lot, all right? Very cool. You can see their detail of how they want to interpret history, but there is some truth in this, all right? Even though they're, you know, putting things in BC times and stretching things out, making duplicates out of people and kingdoms, all right? We kind of can get like an idea of these lineages, right? So again, we're talking about Ham, right? Noah and Ham, right? So they're saying that these Canaanites are kind of like Semitic. I don't know, you know, like, because they're coming out of Ham, right? Even though they're coming out of Noah and the patriarchs, I would say that Semitic or Semitic would be more from the line of Shem. And, you know, Mizraim, Cush, Canaan, as you can see here, Canaan, right over here, Canaan is not of Shem. So, you know, I'm just trying to let you know. But, if you go to Shem, right, and we're talking about Moab, right, we're talking about Abraham and Abraham's brother, Lot, right, that's over here, right, so Terah, who was Abraham's dad and Lot's dad, right, Abraham right here. You see Lot, he has two daughters, and it says Moab, father of the Moabites, Ben-Ami, father of the Ammonites. All right, these are supposedly out of incest with his two daughters. All right, something we got to dig on. Right? I'm not saying that's fully true, but I'm just trying to tell you what it says in the Bible. So I guess if you're talking about Moabites, these are Shemitic because they're coming from Shem. So if you're mixing Moabites and Ammonites, Amorites, with descendants of Ham, which are Canaanites, Cushites, or Mizraim, Nimrod, and you mix these people together, I guess eventually they become Semitic, right? But they weren't always Semitic because this was from Ham, all right? So again, not all Negroes come out of Ham. Yes, he has the progenitor of most of the dark races, the really darker ones in the world, and you know, but not all of them, not the Negroes, all right? So I just wanted to clear that, because that article, you know, it's kind of taking the narrative somewhere, and the best way to put it. Let's go back to the article. All right, so we're back in the article here. And again, he was telling us that Moabite or Canaan is said to represent Negro, right? But we just read the definition of Ham, and it's telling us that, yeah, he's a progenitor of the dark races, but not the Negroes. So his whole thing right here is trying to say that white people or Europeans have tried to make Ham, right, cursed and be the Negro only. And so that's why they're saying Canaan is cursed and all that. And it plays right into their hands, as he's saying here. So he's saying to be a servant plays right into their hands, according to his whole view that Ham is the Negro. And they're trying to make Ham the cursed one, but he wasn't the only so-called Negro. Alright? Now we continue in this book. Right? So it says, in the book Islam in the African-American Experience, Prophet Noble Drew Ali is merely noted as bringing to the Moors in America an alternate identity consisting of Moroccan, Canaanite, and Moabite ancestry. Turner 203, page 9293. Mr. Turner, the author of said book, apparently did not take the time to research if this was the actual identity as opposed to an alternate one. In other works on Islamic movements of the early 20th century, Prophet Noble Drew Ali's teachings in this regard are called innovative. Gomez 2005. One way to say he made them up, as opposed to it being fact-based historicity. You will find similar in most books dealing with the subject of Noble Drew Ali. One of the most blatant examples of the point made above can be found in a work entitled Muslims on the Americanization Path. But how had biblical Moabites, who inhabited what is now the nation state of Jordan, become modern day Moroccans, occupying the northwest corner of the African continent? All right, good question.
Great question. In order for you to know where you're going, it's about knowing where you came from. Now, we're going to say that if you don't understand that what you consider today as the Republican Party is a representation of what they call the Whigger Moore Party. And then how could there be a Whigger Moore Party in the public school system that George Washington was the first president? But they do say it. They say he's the first president elect. In other words, he was appointed. There were seven other men, nine other men, if you will, that were president before George Washington, who were all Moors. Because there's a history of who you are that nobody gets kudo point talking about, but yet they demonstrate it. How many guys remember when Barack made the address of the first nation to show homage to America, when he made the proclamation that it was Morocco and that it was Islamic? It was Islam. It was Islamic laws, not Christian, that he gave that credit to. I know that might be over a lot of people's head because, what does that have to do with what we're talking about? Everything. Let me explain. What you call white supremacy or privileged, these occupiers are here by occupation because they were in place, they were actually placed in charge of your Moorish estate. But see, when you fell away from who you were and you began to take on the identity of somebody else, it's like looking in a mirror and not remembering what you look like. So when we say that you are a victim of identity theft, it's because you want to be white because you feel that white is a privilege. And the ones that actually that you consider white are actually pretending to be you because they understand that in order to have access to the land, they got to be a lodeo, they got to be a native, and even though they wasn't born, they were grafted in like a tree. Some of them married into. So here's where we get into, how do we get here, Bazelle? Women and children were the spoils of war. That's how we got here. The Hague Convention created an ability for those illegitimate children to be considered legitimate. Because if they were adopted into the family of nations and they were given the ability to become human or become human beings, because you're not considered a human being if you're not tied to the land. Let me explain. A United States citizen is not, I repeat, is not considered a human being under the Declaration of Human Rights. Because a 14th Amendment citizen, what nationality is that 14th Amendment citizen? What nationality do they claim? I mean, for everybody that is comfortable being who they say they are, what's your nationality? What is the nationality of a 14th Amendment citizen? I'm very, very, very curious to see, you know, how that all plays out. Hey, Corey, if you can hit me, if you can hear me, man, I think I just clicked you on. Can you hear me? Can you hear me, brother? 9280, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can.
All right. What do you think 14th Amendment citizens, what are their nationalities?
I don't think they have one.
I mean, what are, we just had Memorial Day. I heard some things, so I'm curious. Well, you know, and those of you who don't know, Corey's one of my oldest students. He was in our first class, so he done heard me go through this a couple of times. But let me just check. Maybe I'm missing something. I'm going to go down the line. I'm going to call you by the last four digits so everybody won't get confused. I'm just going down the line. Let's see here. Caller, last four digits of your number is 6918, if you can hear me. If you can hear me, what do you think the nationality of 14th Amendment citizens are? I mean, what is the nationality that they proclaim?
I can only take a guess.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
And I would guess that it would be every nationality not born here in the United States.
That's one way of looking at it. You know, it's like, okay, most 14th Amendment citizens, they will say, quote unquote, I am an American. I'm American, you know. I'm a 14th Amendment citizen. I'm a citizen. You're a citizen of what? America. That's what they proclaim, right? That's kind of what I'm getting. You know, they claim that they are American. I want y'all to pay attention now. I'm just going to just put you back on hold, brother. All right, check this out. They proclaim to be American. Well, one of the definitions of being an American is that you're one of the various copper-colored people. So if you're not a various copper-colored tone people, can you say as a 14th Amendment citizen that you're really being American is your nationality? I don't know. I'm just checking. I'm going to go down the line. Let's see. Who am I going to bring on? Let's see. Caller, last four digits of your number, 7128. I'm just picking on everybody. I'm just trying to see if am I making sense. If you can hear me, 7128, last four digits of your number. If you're not one of the various copper-colored people, can you technically call yourself an American?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear.
No, a 14th Amendment is not an American. It's a different. An American is a Moor or an indigenous person, a indigenous man or woman to the land. But a U.S. citizen, no, that's a corp.
Okay.
That's bad fiction.
Okay. Okay, so
So
it's safe to assume that they are actually, and brother, I'm just going to just put you back on mute just for a second. It's safe to assume that most of these 14th Amendment citizens are under the illusion or they're under the pretense, you know, that they are when actually they're not, because just like the brother just may mention, most of these individuals are corporations, they're fictions. Now, I want you to think about the state of the people who have this belief system, not to add insult to injury, but to just to demonstrate a fact. If they don't have no real clue on who they are, wow, imagine just how much they don't know when it comes to how they are being governed. See, the word sovereign and citizen is like jumbo shrimp. I like seafood, so, you know, hey. I order jumbo shrimps from time to time. But I do know in the English language, at least that's their language. In that regard, when I say they, they go that they again. When I use it in that prefix or context, you know, I know that the word jumbo represents large and the acronym of shrimp means small. And so you're saying big, little. So what are you really saying? Sovereign is free from government. Citizen is under government. So what are you saying? So it's a lot of things we're saying that really make no sense. I'll go here. Sometimes we're using negative words in a positive environment, which also negates the word. We're using negative words, you know, to demonstrate something in a positive capacity. All right, give you an example. If the word begins with D-E and then a consonant, that actually means no in the actual etymology of words. So D-E in front of a, you know, D-E and then another consonant, whatever comes in that consonant, it means no. So D-E means no. Let me give you a good one. How many of you guys ever heard of the word describe? Describe what he looked like. Let me give you a legal description. D-E means no. And so you have after no, then you have scribe. So that means no scribe. You can't script or scribe anything because it means no. So you have to pay real close attention to how the word described is being used. Especially if they're trying to get you to use a negative word to determine a positive outcome. Brazil, how are we supposed to know what we're supposed to be doing? Well, it's like you don't have to look very far. You don't have to go, you know, on a scavenger hunt. You just look within self. Look. Number universal, right? Let me say it a different way. In order for the words that you're using to have a true meaning, it should mean the same thing whether you spell it from left to right or from right to left, or whether you use it from left to right or right to left. In the order how you use it, it should mean the same thing if you're using a different order. If it has a different meaning, one order versus the other, then, you know, it's if it walk like a duck and quack like a duck, might be a duck. See, we are word-controlled people. See, our languages, like I go here, I don't know how many of you guys are musicians, but I'm going to speak to my fellow musicians. We learned the language of Latin because most of the music that's written in a sheet music format is written with Latin words to determine the emphasis of the sounds, the music that's being played, crescendo, decrescendo. You know, all these things have a Latin interpretation. It's no coincidence that the language of music and the language of law both have roots in what? Latin, which just for laughs and giggles happens to be a lot of the more, I'm not going to say native tongue. I'm just going to say it's one of the various different tongues that we utilize. Sort of like this. If you've never used a MacBook computer, you would think that Windows was the best thing since sliced bread until you start using a Mac. That's all you ever used in life was a Mac. And so people who use Mac are definitely Mac users, and those that use Windows are definitely Windows users. But here's the deal. If I'm a computer programmer and developer, I know that both run off of some sort of Unix platform. Especially if I have to fix or repair one of these operating systems. But again, very few people that are in what you consider the computer space or the retail space, they really, really, really don't get off into the developers too. First of all, that's too geeky. That's too much. You know, it is. You know, we're used to certain things. So, unfortunately, what is the average price of a laptop today? I'm going to demonstrate something to you. I need to pick on this. This guy right here probably has a background in computers, so I'm going to bring him on. Let's see here. If I can bring my good brother Lamont on here, because he has a background in computers. Lamont, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
You have a pretty good background in computers and things of that sort, coding. What is the average price of a laptop these days? I mean, really good. You know, like if I came to you and knew nothing about computers, like what is the best computer I could buy, and what am I typically going to spend for the best of the best? You know,
I'll say average between
1,200 to 1,500
Do you think more people are actually buying laptops these days, portable computers, than the old dinosaur desktops that everybody was using? What do you think is being sold more right now, laptops or CPUs?
Definitely laptops.
Okay. Watch this.
No, no, no. The question was, well, you asked me about the average price of a laptop or a computer.
Average price of a laptop.
Okay.
So you okay. So okay. About $1,200, $1,500. All right. What is the average price for a desktop? Watch this.
You talking about best of the best? I mean, that's kind of a...
Yeah. Yeah. Watch this. You listen to the answer now.
Oh, wow. See, that depends on what you're doing with it, right? If it's, if it's, I mean, they're a lot cheaper than laptops, but, you know, if it's a gaming computer, then we're talking about something entirely different. But
notice I said that. From a developer standpoint, depending upon how the computer is going to be used, will determine whether it's cheaper than a laptop or something different. Let me give you statistics. Because, see, I work on the statistics side of computers, and so let me give you – watch this. More people in retail, meaning debtors, more debtors own laptops than actual desktops. In the computer space, the average price of a CPU, a laptop, is about $1,000, like you just said, $1,500. While in the commercial area, the average price of a desktop starts at about $10,000. Because of all the stuff that, like you said, it can do. Now watch this.
Right.
I have already, those of you that are in our syntactical trust class, you know, don't speak out of turn. You know, y'all just be quiet while I break this down. These guys that are already in the banking in the box in the syntactical trust side of the fence, they know the value of a desktop over a laptop. And this is why they've already brainwashed a lot of the population to get away from the big, bulky desktops and get you something slick and elegant like a laptop. Because what you think is more easier to track, to monitor your activities, a laptop or a desktop? This is a trick question.
Probably a desktop.
Desktop has more capabilities, but let's say the gigantic servers of old have become the desktops of today. And if you own your own server, you own your own access point. So, of course, I'm not trying to put you on having your own access point. I want you to tie into my access point. Therefore, I can monitor and control what you do. See, two products, and you notice in your particular space, you have the internet, and then you have the what? The intranet. So, laughs and giggles, just laughs and giggles. Do you think more people are actually accessing the internet or the intranet? This is a trick question. Let me help you out. Most individuals who have internet service, how many of you guys have heard of Comcast? Y'all have heard of that company before?
Right.
Who knows Comcast, right?
Yep.
Comcast offers internet, don't they?
Yep.
All right. Comcast, do you think Comcast has more people with that live in homes or what you would consider a home or an apartment, do you think Comcast has more retail customers or business customers? Watch this.
Retail.
They have more retail, right. Do you think there's a difference between retail internet and business internet?
Fundamentally, no. but they'll tell you that, right? They will tell you that there is slight features. You know, it's the same pipeline for the most part, but it's all about features. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's the same thing. They run through pretty much the same equipment, same access points, unless they're going to run, you know, like fiber or something like that. But at the end of the day, it all leads to the same place.
So why is business internet more expensive than retail internet? You just said a mouthful. I want to make sure the listeners are hearing the responses, because this is all relevant to what we're talking about.
Bandwidth, most part.
Okay, bandwidth. All right. Bandwidth, metadata. If I run a business and I have a business internet account, in your opinion, do I control how my metadata is being used if I'm a business versus a retail person who just has it in the home for laughs and giggles and entertainment? Like, okay, my business, I got to have internet in order for me to take care of my customers. I got to reach out my people in the field. It's a tool for business. All right, so we got that. And then we got, you know, I got a barber shop and I just have internet. So when my people come to get their haircut, man, you know, they can hook their phone and, you know, a little different. You know, the barber shop owner didn't spring for business internet. He just had retail internet because, you know, hey, it was cheaper. I'm just kind of giving you a real life scenario. Now, between the two accounts that access the same access points, which individual do you feel has more control over the use of the metadata? Does the business owner have more access over the metadata? And for those of you who don't know what metadata is, let's just say when you access this information highway, there's an information exchange. We're going to call it metadata. So does the business owner that has a business account have more control over the metadata that's used to access this than the retail person that's accessing it? Who has more protection? And Brother Lamont, your line is still open. Who do you think has more protection?
More protection or really more control?
Oh, good question. Who has more control?
Well, a business owner will more, you know, probably more likely have more control over the metadata,
right,
which is, you know, nothing but information about information.
Right.
Yeah, so that's, you know, I would say the business owner would.
Okay, so here we go. If you use online banking at home on Comcast, regular internet retail, and you enter that password and user ID, we're going to say that there was a disclaimer somewhere that you signed that the information that you share up on our particular portal will be shared by third parties. Let's just say somewhere, you know, for you to get internet, you had to sign something like that. Okay. Now let's say, all right, you're at work. All right, here we go. You're at home, comfort of your home, you're checking your bank account. And then you're at work, at the internet at work, checking your bank account. Which one of those checks do you feel is most protected? The one that you did at home or the one you did at work?
Well, the one that you did at work would be more protected.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
Y'all notice I'm asking the same question over and over again, just different ways. I'm trying to get you to see something. Okay. All right. So if you use the internet at work, and it's safe to assume that the one at work is more secure than what you have at home, why do you get in so much trouble when you use the internet at work more so than how you utilize it at home? Like, what is the – and again, if you never experienced this, just listen to the response. You know, I'm picking on Lamont because he works in the computer industry. But it's things that we hear that we really don't pay attention to. All right, why do you think the employer would have a problem with me on the clock checking my internet at work? I'm asking the same question now.
Well, if you're if you're checking your email at work, you're opening up to the public. You know, I could speak for like every job that I've worked at. That has like an IT department. There's just certain things that you cannot do. Checking outside emails, getting online. You really can't do that, even though a lot of people do it. But you're not supposed to do it. You're not supposed to open up, you know, suspicious emails. You know, blah blah blah, all that stuff. But, there's always typically some sort of policy, an IT policy set up with every company that I work with.
I want y'all to remember these responses, because what if I told you the response that Lamont just gave, this actually applies to accounting. It's just in the information realm. Like he just said, there are rules. It's like, okay, if I work on the IT team and I'm checking for breaches, let's say there's some information in our network that we don't need everybody having. Well, if our system becomes vulnerable, then that information could easily be what? Breached. It could be leaked, you know, preferably to our competition, you know, if I'm in business in the public. So Lamont kind of explained the reason why the public and private don't mix commercially. Okay. And this was before we had computers. It's just that now that we're dealing with the information technology, are we dealing with the internet or the intranet? And a lot of people I know really can't tell the difference. Let's go here. All right, all this is relevant. What if the Hague Convention was like the intranet, right? Private. And what if UCC was the internet? I want you to think about that. I want you to think about the intranet as the Hague Convention and Uniform Commercial Code is the internet. Keep that thinking. I'm going to go down the line. I'm going to see who's paying attention. Watch this. Stay right there, Lamont. I'm going to come back to you. All right. Let me go back, see if Corey's still with me. All right. Hey, Corey, you still with me, man? (9280) Corey, can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Let me ask you a question. If you produce music on your own private server and you have copywritten your music, is your music protected if someone authorizes that music without your consent and or permission?
Not really, no.
Okay. I might ask the question again slow because I want everybody to hear the response. Okay, you create some music that you record on your equipment, you copyright it, and you put it on your own private server. If someone gains access to your IP address and they access your music without your permission, are you protected or are you kind of up the creek without a paddle?
Well, the copyright should protect you.
Mm-hmm.
But it depends, I guess, what information you put on there and all that.
Mm-hmm. So really what you're saying is getting access is one thing, but it's about how the person who access the information, how they use it will determine whether you can use some protection or not, right? Am I reading into that right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Also, just like how the person go about it.
Mm-hmm. I want y'all to listen to the response. A person can go through other means to obtain your metadata, and it's only based upon how they use the data which will determine whether you're protected or not. Interesting. Now, the reason why I'm picking on Corey, even though he's not, just because he's one of my oldest students, is because he has a music background. You know, he does music. You know, he understands copyrights. I'm trying to show you something. Okay. Here's the bull in the room. Uniform Commercial Code, and I'm going to put you back on mute just for a second, Corey. Uniform Commercial Code is the internet, which connects all the information that we're using digitally. Okay? I want you to list, like, in your mind, every computer that is connected to the internet is actually in some form or fashion connected to another computer somewhere else. So if one person puts a document or information into that system, then actually everyone else in that system can, through certain, and I'm not going to talk about them, you know, per se, but can technically access and use that information. Because using the internet, you have no expectation for privacy. But I place that information in an intranet, I do have the expectation of privacy. How would you drive a car that you've never driven before on an unknown highway that you've never traveled before? And let's say, for laughs and giggles, the vehicle that you're driving is a manual shift, you know, and you've never operated a manual shift. Now, let's say you got all those variables. This is the car you always wanted, but you're finna travel on a road you never traveled before. You're going to operate a vehicle that you never operated before. And I'm going to say, well, by the way, there's no insurance on that vehicle. Now, how comfortable would you be operating that vehicle on the highway that you never traveled before, never driving the manual, with no insurance? How comfortable would you be? I'm picking because I'm trying. I want everybody to listen to the responses. Caller, last four digits of your number is going to be 4630 if you can hear me. 4630. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
All right. Did you hear the question I just asked?
I couldn't. You kind of went out a little bit. You said if you were driving a manual car and something.
Okay, like I'm going to give you an example. Would you, how confident would you be if you were given the car of your dreams? But here's the stipulation. You have the vehicle of your dreams, but you've never operated a manual ship before, day in your life. You're going to be traveling on a stretch of highway that you've never traveled before. And by the way, there's no insurance on the vehicle. How confident would you be in your ability to operate that vehicle?
Not too confident. I'm
too confident.
Skittish.
Right. A little skittish. Like, you would almost kind of say, well, if I drive it during the day and I'm only going to go up the road where I know, you know, you find, well, if we do it, we're going to have to create some extenuating circumstances for us to do that. But we're not going to be, you know, we're not just confident to just jump in it and just go all willy-nilly into the night.
Oh, I probably would drive at night when I know it's less people on the highway. Mm-hmm. So I probably drive and then know where I'm going exactly. And it has
right.
to be dire situation.
Right. So notice how she's saying it. And in class, I want everybody to listen to the response because this is all relevant to what we're talking about when it comes to accounting, the Hague Convention, and so forth. I want you to think about the fact that, and I'm just going to just put you back on mute just for a second. I want you to think about the fact that our information is connected, but we don't understand how it's really being used. But we will justify, watch this, we'll justify it may be used one way or the other as long as we can get some sort of benefit out of it. Case in point, you found out that there's a legal loophole where for every child that you claim you can get, just for laughs and giggles, a $600 credit. Now, unless they're going to perform some sort of DNA testing and this, that, and the other, if you just put some information in a system that nobody's checking, some people are going to kind of stretch that rule. What do I mean? Well, you know them kids really didn't stay with you like you said they did, but, you know, it's money. I'm getting a benefit. So I'm willing to stretch it to get a benefit. I'm saying the same thing over and over again. I've been talking about the same thing for 30, 40 minutes. I'm saying the same thing over and over again. I'm just simply trying to demonstrate that in every situation that we encounter, the more we know about the situation, it determines how we deal with it. For example, someone who knows there's a legal way to do what they're doing besides committing fraud, if you will, people will be more apt to take that chance. But, you know, even when they know there's a little bit of fraud there, it's like, well, I'll take that chance because, hey, I'm going to get an extra $600. I split it with you. Notice how we do it. It's nothing wrong with what I'm saying. I just want you to understand what you're dealing with. How does this all tie into UCC and accounting? Okay. The Hague Convention said that, okay, if you operate in commerce under a trust in a Hague country or nation, the validity of the trust cannot be questioned. Well, what the hell does that mean to everybody else that don't speak legalese, Bazelle? Well, that means that everybody else that's not operating under the Hague, well, now they're subject to commerce, the rules of commerce. And the rules of commerce are kind of like this. The rules favor the ones that are willing to report, willing to tell, willing to demonstrate the ability to be responsible in commerce. The system will punish anyone who is not forthcoming and giving forthwith. But Bazelle, I thought whatever I do outside of government is private. Well, who are you? Well, Bazelle, what do you mean, who am I? You know who I am. I'm such and such. Like, no. Who are you in commerce? Are you a debtor? You remember? Are you a citizen? You know, being a citizen is like saying, well, I got no expectation for privacy. So whoever, watch this, the corporations who the rules are written for get to be private while I'm the one that's funding everybody lunch, and they always calling me and asking for my information. Wait a minute, damn it, didn't you call me? How you going to call my number then ask me to verify myself? Who the hell are you? But sometimes we don't even make it to that conversation. We get so defensive. We're so used to fighting. They call us, you know, we're the only people that will go on someone else's job and tell them what we ain't going to do. You know, that's my people. I love my people. My people will come on your job, though, and tell you what they ain't going to do. I ain't come here to work. Huh? My head hurt. My dog just died, you know. I didn't come here to work. That's my people, though. I love them. That's my people. And unfortunately, that attitude creates problems. Things that we should fear and have a healthy fear of, we don't. And the things we got no business fearing at all, we do. That's how control works, you know. The things that should not even matter the most. You know, this is what you lose sleep over, you stress over, and you put yourself into an early grave. And the things that, you know, it's vice versa, you know. That's a form of control. I'm simply talking about the fact that Uniform Commercial Code is what everybody in commerce has to follow up under, whether they're being public or private. It's just that if you're public, there's a set of rules, and if there's private, there's a certain set of rules. Well, I just give you the playbook. If you're private, you write the rules. If you're public, somebody else already wrote the rules. And if you want any sense of semblance of privacy, wouldn't it make sense for you to be writing your own rules than following someone else's rule? I mean, how does the private sector get to keep all of their gold and silver and create commercial paper that all of us are chasing? Where's that written? When did I consent to that? Well, you know, silence is acquiescence. Oh. Well, I didn't know they had a document. I, you know, maybe I want to respond. Well, you know, silence is acquiescence. My ancestors have already consented. So now that I've come up of age and I've read the book and I'm like, well, I want a choice, I choose plan B. Now, when you choose plan B, it's not the system is going to be like automatically the gates are going to open up and they're going to be like, go fruitful and be, you know, multiply, my son. They're going to test you because, you know, even if you get off the plantation, the system ain't going to shut down because you got saved, quote, quote. It's like, okay, great. He got away. There's 100 more that's being born in his or her place. Hey, I like our odds. Problem they got is when you can convince the rest of the herd. You know, do you think turkeys would actually be voting for Thanksgiving if they knew Thanksgiving was really what it was about then? That's kind of like how we are and we don't know what's going on. We're turkeys voting on Thanksgiving, not knowing that we're the main course. That's what we're doing. I want to be financially independent and want to be out of debt. And this is a conversation that I speak a lot of in the Law of Nations courses. I don't want to overwhelm you, so I'm going to say the general population believes that wealthy individuals are somewhat corrupt and evil, and being poor is a sense of righteousness. And no one is questioning, well, who taught that lesson? You know, so I'm holy if I'm poor, and I'm being sentenced to death and damnation and hell if I'm wealthy? I'm really confused now. If you never read an accounting manual, you won't be confused. You think you got this thing all sewed up and you got it. When you read the accounting manual, you'll be like, wait a minute. I'm playing chess. This game is really chess, not checkers. And I've been trying to do this backwards jump moving, and no wonder it wasn't working. I'm playing checkers and it's really chess. Like, the rules of accounting are simply saying you know, whatever you choose, there's a form that supports your choice. But be prepared to demonstrate it. You know, don't just get the answer. Know how you derived at the answer. Because if you can explain the answer, then we're not going to question you. We're only going to question the ones that we know can't answer the question. You know, when the IRS writes you a letter, you know the biggest word they'll say that people miss? The IRS will say you may have committed fraud. The information may be incorrect. That doesn't mean it's incorrect. It's saying it might be. It may. They ain't saying nothing. But guess what? Your lack of response, how you respond determines whether you're giving them merits or not. A legal maxim demonstrates in the Uniform Commercial Code that anything that's done outside of law is to be considered not done. So if you know they're making this accusation outside of law, how are you supposed to respond? With the bills too high, I'm not going to pay it, blah, blah, blah. Or are you going to let the truth stand on itself? Like, okay, well, I agree that this is what I'll do. I don't know what you're saying the problem is, but if you feel I've damaged you, you know, I'm willing. I accept that fact. You know, do you hear people say upon proof of claim? I don't want to tell you sound like a robot. No. I have no problem with giving you what you're asking for. Just show me the math. If you show me the math, then I can get you what you need. Because if you show me the math, I'll get you lawful legal money, which is all you're entitled to get. Why do you keep saying that, Brazil? Because if you're bold enough to show me a bill or what you say I owe and you don't have that same bonus to show me the accounting that got us here, Houston, we have a problem. Because the minute you took this to court because I didn't give you what you wanted, you're committing tax fraud. The Hague Convention just have rules to protect you in that. UCC is like everybody in commerce is expected to be an expert, which means you're supposed to already know it. Look, there's no happenstance or coincidences in commerce. Everybody's expected to be an expert. So what you'll call an oversight or white supremacy or racism is just not personal. It's, you do know that businesses can discriminate. Oh, yeah, I'm going to get people mad at me. Oh, my God. What do you mean they can discriminate? You can't discriminate. Let me be real clear. There are two types of business practices that are protected under contracts. I'm just going to talk about one. The rest will have me to go into the whole law of nations, and I don't think you're ready for all that. So we'll just – all right. If you have a business that actually – let's say, for instance, don't you think about a business where it has – a sign that says we're open and it's flashing in neon lights. And when you approach the door, you can access this business from the outside. Like if it says we're open and then you go to the door and you can walk in through the door, then that is a public business. It's public. Now watch this. A public business that's open to everyone cannot discriminate. But watch what I'm about to say. If I have a business that happened to be in the public and I'm open for business, but when you come to the door to enter my business, someone's got to let you in by invitation, then that's what we consider a quasi-public business. Really a slick private. And those businesses can discriminate on who they will serve, how they will serve, this, that, and the other. Because even though we're in the public, we're not accessible to the public. It's by invitation only. I'm going to open up the call lines to see how many people knew that. You hear the sound of my voice and you just heard everything I just said. Did you know that particular fact when it comes to commerce and businesses? Can you hear me, Cora? You might be still on mute, brother. Can you hear me? We're going down the line. Caller, last four digits, your number is 6918. I'm checking in to see if you heard what I just made mention about the businesses, and if you did, did you already know that? 6918.
No, I did not know that.
Okay. All right. So for FYI, when you go to Kroger's and you go, and it says they're open for business, and when you walk up to Kroger's, can you enter inside of the grocery store at Kroger's?
Yep.
Okay. Now watch this. If you go to Kroger's corporate, you think you can enter those same doors on the corporate side of the fence?
Nope.
Okay. Notice how I want everybody to notice the responses. So, Kroger's to go ahead.
Well, okay. So, mm-hmm. you probably can, but you can only get so far.
Right. In other words,
what about a nightclub?
Perfect one. Nightclub is perfect. See, that's the perfect example that I want you to think about, a nightclub. Nightclub is open, but it's by invitation because you got to get through the code check and everybody else to get in. And it ain't guaranteed that you're going to get in. Just because we open doesn't mean you get in. We can discriminate on who we let in. No, player, you can't wear no Air Force Ones in here. This is dress shoes only, you know. We've got a dress code. You know, we can discriminate. There's nothing wrong with that. Where people get it twisted is that we have a concept. It's like you going to the club and it has a dress code, and you coming in there want to wear what you want to wear, and you arguing with the bouncer that ain't finna let you in. I don't care what you do. I want you to think about the fact that businesses that operate under the Hague, it's like a nightclub with bouncers. Everybody's just operating with the UCCs are like Kroger's that's open for business for everybody. But watch this. Corporate Kroger don't operate like retail Kroger. You know, like you just said, you might be able to get in the parking lot and park, but they're going to have some security on certain levels. Notice how I said that. This security is going to keep coming up. Why? Because it's commerce. We're talking about securities. I'm not going to spoil it for them. Put you back on hold just for a second. Look, they have been playing out this whole banker's game in front of your face the whole while, and you're not paying attention to it. So they're not really doing anything wrong. We're just not paying attention to detail. And things will immediately start to associate with this, that, and the other. It ain't personal. It's business. Now, watch this. The nightclub owner, there's a reason why he got a dress code, and he only wants certain people in his establishment. Fire safety reasons. He might got a special guest. He might got some stuff going on. You know, he might got some people that's doing some stuff that everybody don't need to have access to. I'm going to get real deep for just a second. I'll use my own personal situation as an example. Let's say you know someone who's well-known in the public. Let's say they're famous, you know. So people who have a certain persona in the public, you know, it's a risk if, you know, too many people have access to them, if it makes sense. It's a risk there. You know, you don't know if you got a crazy fan. You don't know what going on. So there's security measures that are in play. Technically, when you're dealing with a private person, they have to increase security. A lot of you are giving lip service saying you want to be private, but you sell yourself short. And then when you get treated a certain type way, you associate the treatment as this, you know, oh, they discriminated against me. Yeah, they can because you can't, It's a trust agreement. First off, you're nothing more than a beneficiary of the trust. The benefit is that you might get a chance to get in. That's the benefit. Might not. Depends on who else is already there. Maybe they decided they are at capacity. You're going to put them over fire code and fire safety reasons. So you know it's a lot of reasons. The point is, if you're a beneficiary in that situation, you really don't have a dog in that fight. I'm gonna get real deep for a second. Everybody that's posting their beliefs and this, that, and the other on Facebook, this is just me. Now I'm just gonna you don't have to agree with what I say. This is just me. This is me. If you are bold enough to put your private information on a social media site, and they done told you when you do that, they selling this information to third parties. If you put that information on a social media site and then you do get visited by the Alphabet Boys, I'm not going to say you had that coming. I'm just going to say, look, that's really like throwing stones. Glass, you know, you're throwing stones, you got a glass house. And if you don't see it now, it's hard for you to see it when you're in the middle of it. For example, technically, if you have a desk, I'm going back. I'm gonna make it relevant. Those of you that don't have, how many of you guys actually have desktops in your home? This is gonna blow your mind. I'm gonna go back down the line. Let's go. I'm gonna go to caller. Caller, last 4 digits of your number is going to be 3059. If you can hear the sound of my voice, call it 3059. Do you presently have a desktop in your home or place of business?
Yes.
Yes. 3059, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
They probably can't hear me. I'm going to keep on keeping on. Let's go to, okay. I'm just picking random folks here. Call the last 4 digits of your number. It's going to be 8677. 8677, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
8677.
Yes, I can hear you.
Last 4 digits of your phone number. I'm checking to see if you can hear me.
Yes, I can hear you. Can hear you. Hello?
Try one more before I go in here. All right, caller. Last 4 digits is going to be 4630. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Last 4 digits is 4630. Yeah, I can't hear them for some reason. They might be responding. I just can't hear them. Let me try this again. Let me close this and try to open it back up. Let's try this again.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I think what it is, they have I ain't saying they forbidding me from hearing you guys. They know where I'm finna go with this question. So you guys just bear with me. Just take notes. All right. Here's the deal. If you own a desktop, even though you might have didn't spend 10 grand for it, it does have a value that can be retailed out at about 10 grand because of the potential of what it can be used for in this information age. So right now, to start contracting, the average desk, the average laptop can retail out at about $1,000, and the average desktop can retail out at about $10,000. So, for those of you, and I ain't gonna call you risk takers, I'm just gonna just kind of give you. This is what accounting says, so you know, so you don't get in trouble. If you control more than 5 desktops at $10,000 a piece. Now watch this. The computer by itself is not the value. So you got to call it a general intangible asset because of how the computer is being used. See, that's where you get away with that. And I ain't going to call it a legal loophole. I'm going to call it an accounting. See, it's how you use these things. The Hague Convention has the same type. I can't really go into that in this public setting, but I can say if you understand accounting and you can take a $400 desktop and get a $10,000 quote-unquote valuation, imagine what the Hague Convention can do for a lot of you guys that are in certain situations commercially, because the validity of a trust cannot be questioned. And a trust is one of the most protected vehicles that you can operate commercially. Yeah, and I know what it is because we're getting to the short end of the broadcast and they want to limit my ability to talk to certain individuals, but it's okay. It's okay. I'm not going to spaz out. I'm not going to panic. I want you guys just to pay attention. Keep listening, because if you listen long enough, you definitely learn something.
It's no secret that the wealthy, especially most famously Bill Gates, are gobbling up farmland right now, all across the nation. Now, to understand why, we have to look at the economic conditions that are influencing these decisions, the people with lots of money buying up farmland. And once you understand the reason why big money is entering plays like this, it might make sense to get on the right side of the fence and get some farmland of your own. And just in case you think that's out of reach, don't worry, at the end of this video, we're going to look at just a couple of ways that it's very, very easy to get in on this play with a very small amount of money. Your name doesn't have to be included in the list of people who were once or currently the richest man in the world. Ready? Let's dive in. For decades, the United States has had a structural trade deficit. When I say trade deficit, I'm talking about the trade deficit, not the budget deficit. For those of you who aren't aware of the difference, a budget deficit is when the government itself has more expenses than income. So let's say they bring out, you know, $1 trillion worth of taxes, but they spend $2 trillion. That's a budget deficit. Just like if you brought in, you know, $100,000 for your annual income, but you spent $200,000, you'd be in the ranks of the United States government budget deficit. That's not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about the trade deficit. The trade deficit or surplus is when you look at the amount of stuff that a country imports versus exports. Basically, the amount of stuff that we make versus the stuff that we buy that other people make for us. Now, usually you'd think something like this can't go on forever, right? Because if all we're doing is constantly just buying stuff from other countries, eventually we're going to run out of money if we're not also selling at least that much worth of other stuff to other countries. But the fact that the United States is the one in control of the dollar and the entire world uses the dollar as the reserve currency puts the United States at an unfair advantage where we, right now, and for the last couple decades, we don't really have to produce anything to sell. All we have to do is print more dollars, send that out to the rest of the world in exchange for stuff. We don't have to have a corresponding amount of stuff we're simultaneously making and selling out to the rest of the world. Now, this seems convenient, right? Because what's the cost of making a dollar? Nothing. We could technically make as many dollars as we want and it wouldn't cost us anything, especially today's day and age when it's just digital. So where's the limitation in this? The limitation comes in the rest of the world. Because right now, the rest of the world is kind of okay with saying, we'll accept your dollars and we'll send you real actual stuff. That's great for us. And then they use those dollars and they, you know, transact and those dollars circulate around the world. But recently, this trend has been reversing. Over the last 10 years or so since the financial crisis, the rest of the world has been de-dollarizing. because they recognized the United States can't stop printing. And when you print money, when you put more money into a system, it dilutes the purchasing power of all the previously existing money that's in the system. So the world for the last 10 years and going forward is on a slow path to slowly reduce their reliance on and dependence on the dollar so that they, at some point, if they want to, they can just say no to America. Hey, we don't want to accept dollars for our materials. We don't want to accept dollars for our food. If you want to buy something from us, you have to give us something other than dollars because we don't want those dollars anymore. Now, here's where the big problem is. The United States, like I said, for decades has run a deficit. We don't make anything that we buy. We buy it from the rest of the world. So if the rest of the world is at some point going to say, we don't want to accept dollars anymore, maybe we'll accept euros, or maybe we'll accept yen, or maybe we'll accept gold, or maybe we'll accept Bitcoin, or whatever it is, America doesn't produce anything. So the only way for us to get our hands on other forms of currency then is to make something and sell it to somebody who can give us that currency. But we don't make anything ourselves. Now, we don't necessarily need other currency to buy that stuff from the rest of the world. We could just make it ourselves. We don't need to buy all the food and all the stuff from the rest of the world. But that would depend on us actually just making it all ourselves. And again, like I said, we don't make any of our own stuff. We buy it from the rest of the world. This means that at that point and increasingly over time, it's not going to be like a light switch moment where it goes on or off and happens all at once. It's a gradual, you know, maybe a couple of years or maybe even longer process. But as we approach that point, that means that inside the United States, any part of our economy that is productive, any amount of food that we do produce, any amount of stuff that we actually do make, becomes exponentially more valuable because all of a sudden we can't get it from everywhere else anymore, so the supply goes down. The only place that we can get it is if we can make it ourselves because the farm down the street will accept dollars because they're mandated to by the United States government at point of guns. It means that American farmland and other things that produce real goods become wildly valuable. And this isn't something new in history. This has happened many times before. One of the most well-known times where something like this has happened was the Weimar Republic in Germany. As they printed more and more money to pay for things, there was widespread poverty. Things got so expensive that it priced the everyday person out of being able to afford basic necessities. Every day, basic necessities were increasing in price. When it gets to that point, the basic necessities become the most valuable because you're no longer going for luxuries, you're going for survival. So poverty was rampant, even though paper currency was innumerably abundant. It was worthless. But this is important. Widespread poverty, but not universal poverty. There were some people that got very rich, and most of these were farmers. That's right. Farmers. It turns out that when everybody's going for survival and everybody has been priced out of all of the basic necessities, the people who actually have things that produce the things that people need to live, like eggs and milk and cheese and meat, those are going to be the people who still have something to sell. And as prices go up, the prices of the stuff that they're selling goes up. Farmers were the only ones, or some of the only ones, who had possessions that produced anything of real value. So every day they sold their eggs and sold them for more and more and sold their milk and cheese and meat for more and more. They got very wealthy because of it. Now, needless to say, this caused a lot of jealousy in other people, and ultimately dynamics like this led to breeding what happened that led up to World War II, the internal cultural hatred, all of that. But people felt taken advantage of, and when they went to these farmers and they asked them, hey, you're getting rich off of us and we're all, you know, in poverty. What are you doing with all this money? They said, paying off our mortgages. So just as a side note, there was a deleveraging because of the inflation. All the money that entered the system wiped out the debt, and the people who had real assets got very wealthy because of it. When the broad money supply, the amount of money that's actually in circulation, increases at the rate that it's increasing at today, which in America is the most we've seen it increase since World War II, the result is broad spikes in the general level of prices and widespread poverty. And these things usually only take a couple of years to work themselves out. But again, like I said, not everybody gets poor. The people who own the assets and the real goods that are actually productive and produce real things get very rich. Farms become very valuable. Land and real estate become very valuable. Water becomes very valuable. Commodities become very valuable. And this is why the rich, you know, most famously right now, Bill Gates, are scooping up, gobbling up, swallowing up farmland like they can't get enough of it. But don't be scared. Knowledge is power. And if you see what's coming and you see big money, smart people moving into areas, you can follow them. Get on the right side of the fence. Very easy for, and very low barrier of entry for, to get access to some of these things. Number one, buy an acre. Put a cow on it. That way you're not reliant on the mega farms. can't buy an acre, buy a half an acre, get a couple of goats. If you can't do that, get a couple of chickens. You need a very small area to have a couple of chickens. A baby chick is like 15 cents. If you don't want to do anything physical and you still want to play off of this, invest in an ETF, like an agriculture ETF. You know, DBA is a good example of an agriculture ETF. You want to invest in water, invest in an ETF like CGW. Very easy to get exposure to some of these things. If you want to invest in commodities, get an ETF like PDBC. If you know history, you see the big money, you see the smart people moving one direction, you can make an educated decision for yourself. And with very little effort and very little money, you can expose yourself to the same types of things. Very low barrier of entry here. Hedge yourself against an uncertain future, and possibly, if we do experience hyperinflation here, some of these things can make you very rich. As always, I really appreciate you guys. Have a good day.
All right. We're going to try this again because I think they just had me just muted slightly. You guys are starting to understand how all this stuff kind of tie in together. So the question is, for those of you that actually, I asked the question, who owns a CPU? So I'm going to go back down the line and see, you know, I should be able to hear everybody this time. So let's just go here, shall we? All right. Carl, last 4 digits of your number is going to be 4630. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I can hear you loud and clear. So repeating my question, do you own or have access to a desktop versus a laptop?
I own one.
The present rules in accounting state that, all right, and it's because of cryptocurrency, how cryptos are being mined, the whole tangible asset space being redefined, you can actually receive, or let me say it this way. Desktops versus laptops, they're going to probably peg you between $1,000 to $1,500 retail that you can go with it, only because the keyword, that what a laptop is a portable computer. So listen to me carefully. The accounting favors the desktop versus the laptop. And in practice, technically, who's to say that laptop isn't part of your own personal cybersecurity network? And any server that's being protected in cybersecurity, you know, they have a minimum and a maximum. So let's just say minimally is 10 grand, maximum $1 million. You kind of following where I'm going with this?
Yes, my CPU in my office is a server.
There you go. So you know,
when I use my laptop, I link up to it.
There you go. And so when it's set up in that manner, you can technically get the full gambit of valuation for that piece of equipment. Especially when it's a vital, like essential, it's the essential part of the business. What's amazing is just like I heard one of the gentlemen just made mention, because, you know, he's in the computer space. Depends upon how you're going to use the desktop, because, you know, if it's a gaming computer, you know, they go far more expensive than just, you know, $1,000, you know. It's all about how it's being used. So, how much do you think a Blade server will sell for if it was used on Wall Street? How much you think that a Blade server that could be used on Wall Street, how much you think that would, what type of valuation you could get for that?
So that's the server that they use upload commodities and stuff?
Right, you know.
Oh,
to actually, say it again.
I would work millions.
Yes, easily. Here's something this is like 12 years old. 12 years ago, we did a segment with Free to Air Media where a friend of mine by the name of Richard, Do I say his name? We're just going to call him Richard. Richard was a guest on Free to Air Media. He helped me with putting together this network. And we covered a segment that talked about that very analogy. Back about 12 years ago, a Blade server could be purchased on eBay for about $600, and you could technically get 80 grand for it. And this was something very big 12 years ago. Now, that was 12 years ago. Like, technically, you could buy a server and repetition it with a certain program and retail it in the commercial space for easily, you know, we'll say it retails for 80 grand. So they were selling it for like 20, 30, and 40. But that's not a bad investment of 600 bucks to profit 20 to 40 grand on something that can be valued at about 80. That's 12 years ago now. With the mining of crypto and how smart contracts are being used, notaries, I'm just going to go here. How many CPUs would you need to justify $1 million valuation?
Doesn't it depend on what you use them for? Or what you say you use them for?
So let's just, you know, I'm trying to take you there. You're there. All right. How many computers do you think you need to list to get that $1 million valuation?
So I'm going to say me personally
because
I am in.
Yeah.
Me personally, probably maybe three computers, three CPUs.
Okay. Now, I kind of did it the low budget way. That is how you utilize leverage buyouts, LBOs. That whole exercise we just did was really a makeshift leverage buyout where you can leverage your general intangibles in such a way where they become profitable to everybody else. Notaries, pay attention to what we're talking about because of what's happening with Dun & Bradstreet. How many computers, all right, if you're doing notary work, notaries, how many computers are you using? And I want you, and this is a trick question. If you're doing notarial work, how many computers are you accessing?
No.
Okay. Let me help you out. If you're doing notarial protests and different works, does some of these documents have?
Yeah, one. At least one.
All right. So let's look about that one. That one that you got, don't it have to connect to another one somewhere?
Yeah, it has to connect to my server.
You have to connect to your server, but your server has to also connect to the server that is housing these documents under UCCs, right? So let's just count the CPUs, just for laughs and giggles. Every time you do a notarial protest, you're always going to be accessing at least 3 to 5 pieces of equipment every time you do this. Let's talk about the IRS just for a second. Let's just say for laughs and giggles, you're going to have to send documentation to the IRS. VIA fax, email. I'm just saying, it's practical valuations that we don't think about because it's not being broken down to us because the authors of these manuals, they lay it out in such a way where if you're in the space, you'll pick it up, you'll ask the right questions, and you'll get the results. If you don't ask certain questions, this type of valuation never really comes up because you're looking at it differently. You know, remember, you're playing checkers in his chess. A notary has to always do noting and minuting. And if you're going to physically be doing it in a handwritten manual, then you probably want a digital copy to back up the handwritten copy. And you're probably going to share it with other notaries, which means you're sharing it with your unit to someone else's unit. How many of you guys ever sent an email out to more than one person?
Yes.
That was the obvious one. You know, so if you share it with at least three CPUs, you kind of see where this valuation is going.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Now, it's a lot of gray area in that, so I hope our dialogue will spark the next person to ask questions. But before we go there, do you have any questions?
I was about to ask a question. So in that, you're basically saying that you would count the CPUs that you touch, per se.
Access
in that transaction or transactions, huh?
Yeah, you would any access point where you're sharing metadata.
So you can, I'm going to say it this way, you can quote unquote book in your ledger those other CPUs that you touch in your transactions, like you would just say you use a bond or an indemnity bond. But the whole indemnity bond isn't used. You just book the part that you didn't use or the part that you didn't need to use, but you still use it because it's on your paperwork.
In other words, you'll be correct. You got to look at this thing mechanically. Every gear touches another gear. And it's every gear that's been affected, you can be compensated for. See, when I talk about an entire assembly, that might be the whole gear assembly or maybe 5 out of 15 gears. Just depends upon what I list. Depends on what direction we're going and what, like we just heard the person just say, depends on how we're using it. See, when we do arbitration, we're all coming into a workspace. So there's different IPS addresses that are accessing that workspace. So technically, I can keep the math very, all right, we're going to say we can't exceed $300 million. And, you know, the bond only covers us up to $300 million. So from zero to $300 million, my job is to substantiate that amount. So we listen to the case. We get everybody to say yay or nay. We get everybody interacting with this metadata. And then the metadata produces digital footprints and other servers. For example, when you receive a debtor's number, you just left 5 digital footprints inside of that Transworld Systems mainframe. They monetize 3 of them immediately. That's why you get a number. And then they leave the other 2 for you to do your thing, which is where your process comes in. Since we're doing all the work, all they're doing is just running it through their system. Now, you start working your process as a notary. You start interacting with the UCCs. That's another whole system. You have to start looking at the fact every time you interact with a system, you're dealing with some sort of institution. If you're dealing with some sort of institution, there's a level of, give or take or ebb and flow. There should be a level of valuation every time it moves from one destination to another. Accounting is set up in such a way where everybody gets a turn and no stone should be left unturned. And whatever you do to one side of the ledger, you should definitely be able to do to the other side. It's not that you can't. It's just that you're not, you may be standing too close to the problem. You know, you might have to step back from it, step away from it, you know, get a bird's eye view, if you will. What's your other question? I feel you may have another question you want to ask.
I kind of do, but I don't know if it. Well, I guess I guess I'm saying, how do you evaluate that? How do you evaluate
the other T's or the other CPUs that your transaction touches.
What is your industry?
So let's just say my particular industry is taxes. I do tax returns.
Okay. So what industry is that? The information industry? Is that the accounting industry? Is it kind of a both? You see how I answer that? You need to substantiate your industry, and each industry is going to have a separate valuation. You just combine the valuations. In other words, if I had to build a cybersecurity system for an accounting firm, what would that cost? If I had to build a cybersecurity system for a law firm, what would that cost? Now, when I get that valuation, I determine a net asset value, then it's real easy for me to do that type of valuation we're talking about. I'm exploiting the industries. Go ahead.
So each time you use those transactions, you would – so, for instance, okay, let's just say in 1 week I've done 10 tax returns. So
right.
Each tax return I would book in my ledger all three of those computers that I touch.
Right, especially if they're different industries, yes.
For each transaction. Okay.
All right. I'm going to give you the bull in the room because you didn't ask it, but I can't let you go without giving this to you. You know when you deal with another person, they're a financial institution, right?
They're a bank, correct.
Okay, all right, just making sure. Okay, any other questions?
So I'm counting that their bank too, or their not
okay.
their bank, but their CPU too. So as my clients upload their information into the portal,
right.
they've
right.
already touched my portal. And then right. I'm touching the portal that my software company is on. Plus,
right.
Okay, I think I get it.
See, that's why when you get into smart contracting, it gets very fun, and that's why you really got to have a real good grip on accounting to really maximize the smart contract space.
So how do you monetize that?
Same way you monetize any other security. Securities are equities. How do you determine equity? Isn't assets minus liabilities equal equity?
Yeah, but now that I'm coming into a different understanding of all of this, it's still all debt.
Another man's trash, another man's treasure.
So, okay, so can you draw a line from that to, let's just say, gold and silver, for instance? So, like the guy was saying on the call, on the radio thing, he was saying something about the differences, like, okay, having money or fiat, he didn't say fiat, but whatever he said, again, he said be it yen, because the dollar is so depleted, you may use yen or euros or, you know, gold, silver, or whatever else you may use. How do you draw a line from the debt to the monetization of? Well, it's almost like you can't monetize the gold, the silver, or the yen, or the euro.
You can.
Whatever.
You have to do it privately in your own system of systems. For example, until I can openly barter and exchange gold, I will use silver. Watch how I said that. Until I can openly exchange gold with you, I will use silver as my barter. I'm going to hold the gold, and we're going to barter silver. And there's a system for us to barter silver just in the commercial zone. The reason why silver was the last precious metal to be removed out of the system, because the system will allow you, if you got silver, to take care of anything commercially and commerce. For example, everything from a bad check to murder to a tax lien or levy, 21 pieces of silver can clear that whole thing up. And if you physically got 21 pieces of silver, you put it in the form of a bond or a promissory note and take that note to the court registered investment system, well, they only are allowed to take in what? Lawful legal money. And so they'll provide a tax form for everybody that's trying to get a what? A credit. What is that tax form? Well, it's called a 1099-C, a 1099-A, a 1099-B, a 1096, a 990. You see where I'm going with this. You got to do the accounting.
Yeah.
So the line is you register your gold and silver in your commercial registry of your choice, and then you allow the fiduciaries to carry out their fiduciary responsibilities. Notaries can determine whether a note can be used or not. So a notary will substantiate that, yes, there's gold that backs this note, and you got to go to this trustee to gain access to that credit and or debit. In the form of a bill of exchange, or this is where the Hague comes back in. The Hague will let a competent trust and trustee utilize the promissory note and bill of exchange. Without a notary, you're going to have to do it through notaries that are already doing it. Here's a hint. If you put it into the Bloomberg space, they may not can do anything domestically, but they can take it across seas internationally and do it. Here's something that we discussed for you know, just not giving up our family meeting, but just kind of show you what we was doing this weekend, is that we discussed with different families internationally the ability for them to be willing to do treaties just to help assist with your sovereignty. For example, if the United States dollar is more valuable in certain countries, it's because they use the dollar to leverage resources. You got 90 seconds before they lock everybody out. So if you hadn't had a chance to call in and you want to ask your question, please call us at 319-527-6090 to get in. Because in the next 90 seconds, they're going to lock everybody out where they can't call in, and you just have to catch us on the replay. Technically, you can bring in someone in an international space to do a treaty of sorts, and then you're able to get gold and silver at a discount because of the leveraging that you have. Remember, the United States dollar has been the world reserve currency, even though it's not backed by anything. That's why they will let you go in another country with the dollar, and it'll be, you know, have all of this value because they're exchanging it for resources. Well, why don't you do that for your family? Like, you can get gold and silver at a huge discount if you go into other countries. And all that can be done with the notary and a few good men and women, if that makes sense. It's been done all the time. But that's kind of what we discussed, you know. That's how we spent our Memorial Day. So the Hague, your line is you go up under the Hague and then hold everybody else under the UCCs. That's the line. Any other questions?
One more. What do you mean about going to, what did you just say about going to the Hague and hold everybody else what?
The Hague lets you do this privately, just like the intranet is private. And then the internet is the UCCs. You just have to simply tie yourself to the private side, which is the Hague, in order for you to do what you're trying to do internationally, domestically, through UCCs. You don't get into the whole state and federal legislation because that's governing the other side of your equation. These agencies work for you. When you're operating under those principles. Now, if you want to play checkers with them, then that's when you get in bed and now you know, you're a citizen again. You remember what we said about citizens, remember? You remember that whole presentation we did about citizens?
Not quite. You did it today?
Yeah, we did it earlier. You might have wasn't on the class earlier. All right. Citizens, is a 14th Amendment citizen, do they have nationalities?
Citizens do not have nationalities.
Okay. So if they don't have any nationalities, they're not considered part of the human family. So we can't really talk about sovereignty. The Hague, you're so far out of the Hague because you don't have a nationality. You're not tied to no land nowhere. Who are you? Look, the Hague was designed to legitimize all the children that was born out of wedlock, quote unquote. If you don't use the Hague, then you fall up under that other what? Jurisdiction. Heaven forbid if your name is John's son, Ella's son, Miller's son, Jack's
wow.
son. Kind of see how this other stuff kind of ties in?
Yeah.
See, corporate fictions get away with because they're not real. They're make-believe, so they play less pretend. They pretend. You know, that's why they had to be given. Look, if you don't have a name that ties you back to the land, Microsoft got more rights than you because property can't own property. And Microsoft was given sovereignty corporately because you're Jack's son. Follow me?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. If we don't have any other questions, I'm going to go down the line because I want to see who's been paying attention. We should have some questions. Let's see. I'm going to go down the line. I'm going to call the last 4 digits of your number, so be ready. Caller, last 4 digits of your number is going to be 8677. I'm checking in to see if you got any questions, comments, or concerns of anything you heard up until this point.
Yes, we do.
All right.
How you doing, Brother Ben?
I'm doing great, doing great.
So when you were talking about the server,
mm-hmm.
right,
mm-hmm.
You were talking about the intrinsic value of the server, right?
Intrinsic value of the server, and then also there's a general intangible valuation that a lot of people are missing, because the reason why the crypto is such a hot topic, okay, I'm going to talk apples and oranges here. Before we had crypto, if you had an insurance policy, that insurance policy could actually be considered its own private bank. So people who didn't know that would just say my insurance policy is worth $250,000. Those that understood that having an insurance policy that could be leveraged into a private bank would get a $5 or $6 million valuation on the potential of that policy, because that policy could be used to lend to other business owners. So it's all in how you what? Use the asset.
Yes. Yeah. Using its full capabilities instead of just partial.
There you go.
Wow. So, being new to this trustee class, I'm understanding getting out of possibilities and maximizing, you know, what the usage is on, you know, each instrument.
Correct.
So now I'm understanding what the utilization of the UCC one, you know,
right.
It's private use and it's public use. And learn how to maximize as a private person. Okay.
Correct.
I'm understanding it now. Now that you're doing the descriptions, I'm understanding it now and why it's so valuable.
Right. This is why there's certain spaces. When we talk about 8302 tax returns, these are tax returns that are done with UCC1s. There's a couple of industries that are notorious for doing it. If you just happen to be in oil, as a commodity, that most of these individuals know how to do an 8302 return because they do it all the time. And they do 4 returns a year. That means every quarter they're getting back everything they spent.
Wow.
But that's in the oil industry. Right. And that's like an unwritten rule. Like if you get a lawyer who specializes in oil contracts, they all know that. So it's a race to, you know, like, for example, I'm gonna kind of give you some homework. All right, you guys you've heard of a television show back in the days called Dallas, right? Y'all remember Dallas?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So for homework, I want you to go to season number 2 of Dallas. I want you to go to season 2, episode 5.
If you watch that episode, they're going to give you in a television program how what we're talking about. They're going to give you a real life example in that episode. Like literally from drawing up the contract to how they leveraged it with the bank.
Wow.
See, J.R. Ewing is actually J.L. Hunt. And if you know anything about the Hunt brothers, they control the silver in the United States. Right. Yeah. See, J.R. Ewing is J.L. Hunt.
Yeah, they have a valuable seal.
Very valuable seal. You know, remember one of the Hunt brothers, his oldest son started the NFL.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, and they independently started the NFL outside of federal guidelines.
Right, that's why it's not for profit.
Yeah, only way
it's a not for profit.
Yeah, only way the federal government can come in is through mediation.
Right.
Wow.
Right. So there's a lot of history there. So for just a short history lesson for new trustees, and even for you guys who you've heard me say this, you know, numerous times, go back and watch season 2. If you watch the whole season 2, you're really going to learn a whole lot. But especially the episode between 3 and 5, that episode is very intriguing. Because the series of Dallas starts out, they're in the middle of a potential war between what? Two families. There's the Barnes and the Ewens. Bobby done end up marrying, you know, a Ewing. I mean, a Barnes girl, you know. And when he married, you know, the Barnes, a whole storm started. And so the episodes start out with these two families are all arguing over oil.
Wow.
The first episode, the brother is on television because he's a district attorney. He's prosecuting Jock Ewing, who is J.L. Ewing's father. You know, he's prosecuting him on television. You just got to watch it. Sometimes, see, you know, I'm just going to say, before they do stuff, they got to show it to you. And see, J.L. Hunt, you know, he had enough money where he had his own radio station. He put his own propaganda out there. He said, look, I don't need the government to lie to me. I put my own propaganda out there. So, you know, that was the other reason. J.L. Hunt was just a real interesting character. That's all I'm going to say. But go back and watch that. That'll help you out. If you want to know how to do a good contract, just watch Dallas a few times. You'll figure it out.
Yeah, and the next question. So with social media, that should be a no-no for any private person.
You got to understand that social media is a tool designed for surveillance. So, you know, if you happen to be in the surveillance industry, it's great. You know, but it's just like to use social media and then expect privacy, that's an oxymoron. That's like, you know.
So,
you know, if to use it, you should have no expectation for privacy.
They're in your business.
Yeah.
Right. Right. That's why people are. Right, so you got to really understand. People think Mark Zuckerberg runs Facebook. He doesn't run Facebook. You know, he's got private owners. He's just a face.
Yeah.
But see, everybody mad at Zuckerberg and talking about, you know, how Facebook. No, it ain't. This is the private people. They want what they want. That's why you literally, you'll watch, like, I tell a lot of young men, especially the ones that are battling with the system, I was like, when I left the system, you know how many indictments the federal government has off of your Facebook profile? Like, they're conducting indictments off of your Facebook profile. So all these people that you have befriending you and being your friend, hey, what did you hear the guy say at the beginning of the civics class? all skin folk ain't kin folk.
and that's truly right.
All skin folk ain't kin folk.
We're actually on a certain platform, retail platform, and we're selling items.
Right.
So with these items that we're selling, now we can utilize that platform and just have a representative instead of utilizing our private sales, right?
Right. Like I'll go here. You will see companies that have a public presence, but they're private. I'm gonna give you some keywords to pay attention to.
Okay.
The CEO is not the same as the founder. The founder is private.
Yeah.
The CEO
yeah.
is the person everybody gonna blame when it go crazy in the public.
I told you. So We've always talked about that, and that's why I get out of black business genre, because everybody's a CEO of their business, and they wonder why their financial documents are being taken.
Right.
Or why they come under attack.
Now the positioning. I've been watching this since we actually started learning about. The trust and the private entities. I've been watching some of the trust companies and how they function as financial institutions, and looking at the association of public entities, and it's so dynamic because the face of the product used to be an old representative of Pepsi, but he knows how to function in his capacity to keep the founder out of the way.
Right. That's the whole purpose. See, private families practice. They live, breathe, and sleep privacy. And they do a lot of things, which you don't even know who they are. And so you can't, they're not supposed to be in the public. Like, we'll go here. The board members, y'all remember, was it Elon Musk? These individuals got in so much trouble with their board, that their board took the company from them. Because they're in the news all the time. Like, you're doing too much in the public.
Yes. It's funny. The first trust family that I learned about was in 1955. It was the Sackler family. They actually created the opioid epidemic.
Right.
And the whole business was under Purdue, the Purdue Foundation and Cumberland Foundation, but actually under the Purdue Trust. So the family actually transferred the money out of the Purdue's trust and put it into the family and bankrupt the business and kept the revenue.
Right. That's perfectly legal in the aspect of a business, because, see, when you go in business, you're going in business taking on that calculated risk. You might make money. You might lose everything. That's the risk. But they have a way, listen to this, they have a way of winning even when they appear to be losing, because that's the whole game. When Microsoft got hit with the antitrust lawsuit, they gave over $100 billion away to charity. That they didn't lose, they won. They gave government a handout, and they transitioned into the private. That's the thing. See, we have it so backwards. So you want to pay attention to the leaders that are out front, because they'll teach you. You'll see it. You'll learn it, because you'll see it.
It's in plain sight.
It's in plain sight. It's just that you got to look at it. That's why it's like you have to look at – I tell folks, my brother, he's a real big sports fan. I used to be – I play sports, but I'm older now, so I look at things different. Me and him get into a debate where he can tell me every stat that every NFL or NBA player can go, but I always hit him back, well, who's the CFO and CEO? And he look at me like I'm crazy. Like, well, until you can tell me that, then I don't, I only watch sports when it's convenient. That's my interest. It's like I don't get excited about that. It doesn't.
No.
You want to excite me, tell me what they earned last year. Then I might, it make more sense to me then.
Yes, exactly right. Exactly right. Thank you so much.
All righty. I'm going to go down the line. I'm going to see who else got any questions, because we're in the Q&A section right here. Let's see. Let's go now to – let's see who we got here. All right. Let's go to caller. Last four digits of your number is going to be 3059. 3059. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. I hear you.
All right. All right. I can hear you now. All right. You got any questions for me? You got any questions for me?
Oh, my God. No, I'm just trying to connect all the – I guess it's kind of harder for me because I'm not really active right now. I'm not doing anything that I can connect all this to.
Well, so, do you have any questions?
I'm following you, though. I'm following
mm-hmm.
you. I understand okay. what you're saying about the contract and the leveraging and the desktops.
Right.
And stuff, but I don't know. It's just that I'm not getting all the pieces together right now for some reason.
Okay. Well, tell me what you got. What comes to mind? What is one thing that's kind of got you baffled? I'm see if I can help you out.
It is like okay. You were saying, I understand how when the like, I don't know who that was on the line, but they were doing taxes. And I
mm-hmm.
understand whatever system she goes to connect for her to submit those taxes, there's different organizations she has to go through. So that's another
right.
a PC she had to go to. But how
correct.
Was she like, I don't understand how she monetized that. I don't know.
Okay, let's break that down. All right. The concept of monetization is really, I want you to associate, you have synonyms, which means words that are similar. And then you have antonyms, meaning words that are opposite. So we're going to deal with synonyms. The synonym for monetization is securitization. So when you're talking about monetization, meaning the act of monetizing something, then you're actually
mm-hmm.
securitizing. So you're actually turning that thing into a security through securitization.
Okay.
So the similarity is to monetize means to securitize. If I securitize something, that means it's actually a security that can be used in commerce. So your question, how do I securitize that valuation of the transaction moving from all these CPUs? So
mm-hmm.
the line is when I'm in commerce, whether I call myself a bank or not, I am considered a financial institution. So I'm not
mm-hmm.
going to say that I moved anything in my bank account. I'm going to call myself what everybody else calls me. I'm a financial institution. Well, a financial institution gets a much higher valuation in commerce than little old me. So they have commercial insurance that's tied to a financial institution. So that's why we talk about, well, the public gives you $250,000 worth of insurance, and commercial insurance starts at $1 million. So it's a very safe assumption to minimize your transaction to at least $250,000 up to $1 million, because that's the commercial space that all financial institutions are in. Now, you just
mm-hmm.
multiply whatever you determine from that $250,000 by how many what? Institutions you interacted with. So if you interacted
okay.
with five institutions, then you can take $250,000 multiplied by five, or you can take the $1 million and multiply it by five. That's your valuation.
To for all of her clients.
There you go. Because just like I told her at the end, remember, rather, you know, if you are in commerce, according to the currency transaction reports, you're considered a financial institution. So your clients aren't just clients, they're what? Financial institutions.
And
why
so,
do you
and
think
that would be?
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
I'm saying, why do you think everybody in the public wants you to fill out an application so they can record that information? Because whenever there's an application,
mm-hmm.
a registration, and all right, so there's three things that determine whether you're in a trust. an application, a certification, and what we would call a memorialization or a registration. So whenever an application has to be registered somewhere and then it has to be certified, you're in a trust mm-hmm. agreement. So everybody in the public wants you to what? Fill out an application that they're going to yeah. register and they're going to certify it. That means you're thinking, I'm just getting a loan. No, you just formed a trust. And oh. they get to monetize that trust how they see fit. So every
oh.
right. That's what, and so what you're supposed to do is do the what? The exact same thing.
Because
it's your choice. Now, if you don't know that's what's happening, now guess what? Now you're looking for somebody else to tell you what to do. A trustee isn't looking for somebody telling what to do. A trustee is telling you what he's already what done. Mm-hmm. Debtors are looking for somebody to tell them what to do. Creditors tell everybody else what to do. So if you are a creditor, you don't need anyone to tell you what to do. You just got to be like, this is what we've already done.
So
and the only way you can really...
Be,
mm-hmm.
yeah. So my next question would be the accounting aspect then.
Mm-hmm. The accounting concept that you would use, which will be the entity concept, which when you look into your accounting manual, you'll see the entity mm-hmm. concept. Just study the entity concept to know how to apply it in what we just talked about. Because you got assets equal liabilities
mm-hmm.
plus equity. So in order for you to monetize something, you got to have the assets minus the liabilities equals equities. Because equity is what you're going to be able to what? Leverage. So when you do that valuation, you're turning that equity, you know, in securities. You always hear the stock market talking about they're trading what? Securities. They're trading equities. You can trade equities privately. You guys got to get the valuation down. The accounting equation to do this type of securitization is assets minus liabilities. The other way to get the capital coming back to you, so notice how I'm saying this. In order for you to monetize a transaction, you must use assets minus liabilities, which will determine your equities. In order for you to mm-hmm. recoup capital that's owed to your estate, you got to use the equations assets equal liabilities plus equities. So you don't
plus equity.
There you go. So write these down so you don't get them confused. In order for you to bring it back to your estate, use assets mm-hmm. equal liabilities plus equity. In order for you to monetize a security, you need to have assets minus liabilities, which gives you what? Your equities.
Yeah.
And the accounting concept okay. you're going to use is going to be the entity concept.
Mm-hmm.
That make a little bit more sense to you?
That make yes.
Okay, good, yes. good, good. Okay. Any other questions?
No.
Okay. All right. I'm going to go down the line. I want to make sure I get to everybody. Let's see. Who else we got here? All right. Caller, last 4 digits of your number is 6918. 6918. I'm checking in to see if you got any questions, comments, or concerns of anything you've heard up until this point.
Well, I had the same questions that everybody else had.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still a little... You know, I wrote down the entity concept, mm-hmm. so I guess I just need to read up on that. And
right.
Yeah, I mean, same question. You answered it. I don't think I can ask the question any different.
Okay. It's once you study in your accounting manual the entity concept, then it'll make more sense to you. Now, again, for you guys that are in our Law of Nations class, FYI, I got presently on our website three books that needs to be purchased in order for you to participate in these classes. Now, I'm going to kind of give you this a general layout. I have one book that is a premium tier manual which explains this stuff in detail. Now, that is the book that is in the Banking in the Box manual series. So that's like the premium. So a lot of how do I do this, what does it look like, is going to be in that book. I privately published it because when you're dealing with it from a law of nations perspective, it depends upon, like I always say, who you are in terms of which way you should go. But I lay out extensive details. And once I kind of interact with you, kind of getting a feel for what exactly you're trying to do when it comes to your estate, I'm legally allowed to reproduce 1,200 pages from my original work. Well, those 1,200 pages are going to be specifically catered to what you're trying to do. In other words, you're going to have not only a blueprint, but a working roadmap with instructions and examples. That's just on the that, and that's for folks that are doing platforming, banking. You guys were just talking about monetization. It has all that in there. Then I have the middle of the road. The accounting manual is kind of the 500-page manual that I give everybody on steroids, because now I'm going into details with each equation. And because it's comprehensive or continuing education, that manual allows you to take what you're learning accounting-wise and apply it with the working legal team. You know, I have some contracts with a couple of law firms that'll carry out what you're trying to do. You just got to construct it properly. But it lets you take your accounting theory and get it into a working mechanism. And there is some interactive support and access points, as we just covered, you know, earlier, that you get with that. And then last but not least, you have the private banking manual. Private banking manual is going to be all things banking. That's from insurance, that's for negotiable instruments, the whole nine yards. Each one of these manuals, if you purchase them outright, I will reproduce the publication physically, which I'll get an opportunity to get you some things that I can't discuss here that I'll get to you directly from my hand to your hand. In that regard, a lot of your come from is over the last 7 years of just Q&A, case study, and applicability. You know, so I have one part of the book that's written totally on concepts that others have used, and the remainder of the book is written on things that we have used collectively as a group, you know, with real life case studies and things of that sort. I try to make the ebooks interactive. And what do I mean by interactive is there are special links into certain servers that you can't get publicly that these ebooks will tie you into. Those of you know about, you know about computers and the internet. So let's just say for security purposes, I have secure links in the ebooks that you can access that will give you the other side of what you're looking for. So for those students that are in the Law of Nations classes, you can go to diversityholdings.net. You would go to the section that's entitled More, M-O-R-E. You'll hit the drop menu, and then you'll see where it says online store. And then you will go there, and you'll see the books there, the pricing that are there. Once that order is placed, it will alert us here, and then we'll go into production from this standpoint. But you will, within 24 hours, receive an ebook link that you can immediately download your copy, and then we'll send you a physical copy with the other bells and whistles of what you're going to need. But I'm, you know, once I get those orders in, I kind of go into making sure that I'm critiquing something special for the estate versus just giving you a cookie cutter, because it's a lot of information, like a lot of information. And it's probably way more information than most of you really need, but it's more than enough to get you from point A to Z. without any problems because you're going to have most of the resources at your disposal. But that's what I've released up until this point. There are other manuals, especially on the tax side of things. I got some things that we're doing now with CECL that if you're already in the platform and you're trying to figure out how to do, just like you just said, monetization, securitization, I got a whole series in that that have been published as well. But that's on special request because I have to know in advance who wants what for me to roll it out. But that's just FYI. Any other questions?
Oh, I hate to actually repeat it again, but which one of the three manuals cover everything? Was it the banking in the box manual or?
The banking in the box is going to be tier. It's going to be top tier. So it's going to be everything. It's like out of the three that's being offered, the banking in the box manual is going to be the most thorough and comprehensive because it's going to go into an accounting equation and example. Like you use this in this example. So if you're doing a real estate purchase, then you use it this way. If you're using it for acquiring a corporate vehicle, then you would, you know, it's going to go into something like that, if that makes sense. It's going to get into those specifics. You also get, with the bank in the box, we did, I do have an interactive link which will get you access to a terminal. What terminal am I talking about? I'm talking about a Bloomberg terminal. You know, we can't be banking and not have access to a terminal. The accounting manual is kind of the middle of the road. The private banking manual is going to be all things banking. You know, I got about, you know, some really good sections in there dealing with insurance. Like there's some things that we hadn't even discussed in the insurance side of the things. You know, that usually when people read it and they get a real good working knowledge of it, it changes. It changes. You know, I kind of used the example just earlier. You know, if you got an insurance policy, people who don't know, they're only evaluating the policy based upon the face amount of the policy. Well, if you understand the use of the policy, it's just like the example I use of hanging a painting with a shoe. If you're in banking, that policy is a product. You follow me? It's a product. Like, you acquired the policy just like a person who starts a mortgage bank acquires a warehouse line. You know what I mean by warehouse line, right? If I'm a lender, I can acquire a warehouse line, which that warehouse line is like a line of credit that I use for loans for my clients. You follow me? It's like the company has a warehouse line, and from that line we create loan products. So
y'all seen those commercials where not too long ago, and they're probably running right now to this day, where they're allowing you to cash in, not all, you don't have to cash in all, but you can cash in some of your insurance policy. Like companies are, you know, advertising that.
Right, because those are what we consider in the, that's like, okay, that product is called a COLI, like COLI. That's a corporate-owned life insurance. And companies have a right. Remember, companies took a beating during COVID, so they can leverage those policies. See, employees that are no longer employees with the company, the company took out a life insurance policy on that employee. And even though you don't work for the company, they still got that policy. So they roll into a new type of product and rebrand it. Yeah, so you're exactly right. That's that's them spinning that product off. Yeah. That's done. That's been done since COVID. Yeah. Makes sense. So that's an example. Definitely an example. Any other questions? Any other questions? All right. If we don't have any other questions, what I want you guys to do is lock in to 365. I will be introducing a brand new link for you to basically not only hear what we're talking about, but to see this stuff in real life examples. Let me explain to you what's about to happen with our YouTube link. Probably in the next 3 days, I'm going to be removing a lot of my stuff off of YouTube only for privacy purposes. I may from time to time still launch it, but we're going to be using a private network. In order for you to access this private network, I'm going to send you a link that you can access. Those of you that actually have access to a Roku or any type of, like for example, those of you that have children that are into video games, they're probably going to have some sort of Xbox or PlayStation that they have. Well, if you have one of these things in your home, you can have access to our programming. I'll send you the link on how to access it. But I will be putting that up within the next few hours on our website, which is diversityholdings.net. I'm going to be going over a document that I wrote over the weekend. Well, I actually, you know, it was a passing thought with dealing with the family called What is the Difference? And it's talking about what is the difference between money and real money. I'm going to be doing that live on that network. Within the next few hours, I'm going to do it on 365, and then I'm also going to show you what I'm talking about with the document. So if you want to see that exclusively on how, because some of you folks have never seen real money before. So I want to get you very familiar and acclimated with knowing the difference, because if you know the difference, you know how to utilize it. Look, I appreciate everybody's time and energy. Stay locked in to 365 Live. If you got any other further questions, comments, or concerns, post it in the Bitrix space. Within the next few hours, I will be launching a new link so you can actually watch the presentation I'm going to be doing. I'm going to do it exclusively on that network. But I may allow 365 to pick it up as far as the broadcasting are concerned, but I will be going over those documents in great detail. I appreciate everybody's time and energy. This is not the end, only the beginning. As long as you guys keep doing what you're doing, we're not going anywhere. So I'll see you on the other side. We're getting ready to go on to 365 shortly. Peace and love, family. Peace and love.
Holy are you. Holy are you. There is no God
yeah.
but you.
Uh-huh.
God but you.
I need to talk to y'all for a minute.
Praise be the Lord.
Get serious for a minute.
Holy are you.
Why they call me the God MC, the lyricist. Trace this staff to the roots from Genesis. The world wonder, I'm still standing like pyramids. Design so vivid, every brick it got a story to tell. My rhyme flow different like a hieroglyphic. Mind prolific, infinite, like mathematics. The first language, now add that and add graphic. Go ahead, then go let the block know it's the gospel. Life's new manual, so watch close. The new Michael Wands and lower Pablo Picasso. Prepare to show you the cosmos and rock flows. Even my lyrical man.